Good day, nerds, and welcome to episode 96 of the Nerd Cantina Show. And today is a cantina conversation with our book reviewer, Megan McCarthy-Bianc, and Margaret Owen. And Margaret Owen is the author of the Merciful Crow duology, which the second book in that duology is coming out here in a couple days on August 18th. And in this interview, Megan does a phenomenal job of discussing with Margaret her writing process and how she gets these stories told. Whether you just happen to be one of the book nerds of the Nerd Cantina, or you happen to be a fan of Margaret who stumbled upon this interview, it really does do a great job of speaking in depth with Margaret, her process, her characters, and many other topics around this book. So without further ado, let's just get to it. And here's our interview with Margaret Owen.
We are here today with Margaret Owen, author of The Merciful Crow and upcoming Faithless Hawk, the sequel to The Merciful Crow. First of all, Margaret, thank you so much for taking the time out of your schedule. And during these crazy times that, you know, the world is in right now, whatever your daily schedule looks like these days, we really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us and, getting our readers and listeners to get to know you and your work a little bit better. So we really appreciate that.
Of course. Thank you for having me. It's actually a really nice break to do these interviews. It's a nice refresher.
Yeah, no, I bet. whichever way works. So I'm understanding this right, this is your first, The Merciful Crow, the first installment, it was your very first published work. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. So, can you tell us about your background, what got you into, because I know I was reading your biographies, before, today, and also while reading your books, it's kind of just to get to know more about you and how you kind of jumped all over the place as mm-hmm. far as your career goes. maybe just give us a little insight into your background and maybe how you start writing this story.
Mm-hmm. So I was always, even from when I was very young, I was always reading, writing, drawing. Those were my three big things. And, of course, I had to go to school and do homework and fun stuff like that. And I remember, still just absolutely loving those things. And that was what I really wanted to do. And then as I got older, the message that I got very strongly was that, creative careers, being an artist, being a writer, just wouldn't be a sustainable career. Mm-hmm. And, it ain't wrong. The circumstances for that to be a sustainable career are very limited. But as a result, I just kept on trying to find, something else that I could do with my life that would feel meaningful. I worked in politics for a little bit, not anything too high level. I was mostly just working with campaigns as an organizer, which got me some very interesting stories to tell from the field.
Oh, I bet.
It also gave me a lot of insight into just, even the most fine-grained, ridiculous office politics and stuff. Mm-hmm. Even if, you're working for something you really believe in.
Hypothetically. Exactly.
Right. Hypothetically, everybody else believes in it too, but there's all these kind of weird complications. But, I did that for a bit and, then I remember about this was early 2013. I remember walking out of an informational interview and just saying to myself, there's no way I can make a career out of this. And every time I have tried to, I've tried another job, I've switched between things, or just, in my free time, I keep on coming back to storytelling, to writing, to drawing, I keep on coming back to that. Why don't I find a job that I can hold and let me write in the meantime and see if I can make something out of that? And so I did that. I did a couple different jobs while I was working through The Merciful Crow. And then the offer that I got on The Merciful Crow and its sequel and then a third book, that cumulatively was enough for me to say, I can budget this to sustain me through the time it will take. Yeah. And so that's kind of how I wound up actually jumping into full-time writing with my first book, which is kind of wild. And I still feel just absolutely blown away that actually worked.
Wait, this is happening.
Very happy about it.
Yeah, no, exactly. That's really cool. Right? So is this, it's just a duology though, right? Were you in originally intending it to be a trilogy or okay.
It's complicated. So the short answer is that when a book when the book went to, or, you know, when people were sort of saying, okay, well, we're kind of interested in this book. We might want to pick it up. We might want to publish it a little bit. Would there be more sequels? My agent said, can you get me some pitches? And we originally pitched the story as a trilogy. And then when it was acquired, the final rounds in the auction, both were for duologies. And win the auction, my publisher added a third book onto it. And so, there was kind of, you know, a period of time where things were a little up in the air about whether or not it would be a duology or trilogy. And I was just sort of at the end of the day, I was like, I need to write the story. I know how it ends. And I think it'll just be safer for it to be a duology. And I can just, I know for sure that it's going to end the way I want it to.
As you being the storyteller and having all these ideas, I'm sure, you know, there were some storylines or details or anything that you maybe had to say goodbye to in order to like make sure that you know you met the deadlines or the requirements and all that. So so the Merciful Crow released last year, correct? So and now this Endless Hawk is releasing in next month. Right, or 2 months. Yeah, next month. Okay. So,
yes.
Yeah, yeah, August 18th, exactly.
August 18th.
So, how has that process of maybe, you know, from concept to completion, like either it's writing the story, going through the edits, and then doing all the, like, the whole marketing, because you're like in the home stretch here for releasing this sequel. So, like, how did this release differ from the first book, you know? Just happening to be caught in, you know, the world's like on fire and everything, and we're so restricted in,
right.
in how you can market yourself and market your books and market, you know, this project and this like completion. Like, so how what were some of the bigger challenges and you know, what came out of that?
There have been some challenges that have been typical and challenges that have been atypical. So the typical things, the typical challenges are when you are marketing a debut, you are basically just launching something that is an unknown quantity into the world and hoping that people are interested enough that they pick it up. And I think something that you have to get used to as a debut author, specifically from my experience in YA, I don't know if it's different for other genres and categories, there are people who will just kind of almost performatively dislike your book. And, you know, they will be very loud about not liking it and try to get that into your radar. And, you know, it's for different reasons, and sometimes they don't get it into your radar, but they will just kind of do this, you know, oh, well, I don't have to worry about stands from this author getting on my right. And so, yeah, that can be something.
Oh, no, it's fine. It's fine. This is good stuff for us. So.
But
it's part of the process, right?
And so you know, that's definitely something that you have to cope with as a debut, is realizing that people are going to kind of try to build their brand off of disliking books, and sometimes it includes yours. And and on the flip side, you know, there's a lot of wonderful things about, you know, people who really resonate with your book, and that is always just incredible. But you know, that's one of the challenges of specifically being a debut launch. When you are doing a sophomore book, when it is a sequel, the challenge is that you can market a debut and the first in a series to anyone. You can only market a sequel.
Yeah, your audience, that makes so much sense.
You're limited.
It's a good point that your audience you're much more is limited. Kind of heavily segmented into whoever heard, you know, got into the first one.
Right. And the, you know, It's kind of a fine line, because there is a pickup of people who are like, oh, dang, I should read the first one now that the second one's almost coming out. And they're also like, oh, hey, it's only a duology. I can pick it up and, you know, read the sequel next month and be done with it. So that's, you know, that's a plus, but you have to balance this fine line between throwing red meat to the fans who really loved the first book and finding a way to appeal to people who haven't been
lured into the, you know, into the tiger pit yet. You bring up a funny point about people who are like, oh wait, like the next book's coming out really soon, I can go ahead and start on the first book now. I can't tell you how many times I've started a book just because it's been on my to read list forever. And I finally get into it and I'm like, oh my God, this is like really good. And then I realize it's a trilogy and I power through the first two books in like a month. I have to wait like half a year for the third. Yep. And it's almost as bad as like, if not worse than, you know, being a devoted fan to like a film or movie franchise. Cause it's like, God, you have to wait, you know, a year between installments, but then if you're missing it, like maybe you can at least binge watch something to hold you over. But with reading, it's kind of like, okay, it's still enjoyable to reread, but it's like, it still takes longer than 10 hours. I don't know, depending on how quick anybody's reading it, but still. yeah, no, that's so funny that you bring that up, because I've struggled with that so many times where I'm like, no, like I didn't realize like the story continues and I won't get back to it. I know, right? So
I did this to myself.
How did you come up with this idea of like, you know, this system, the society would split up into caste based off of bird species and kind of pairing the magical abilities depending on you know, where what group they belong to.
Well, to quote the great classic movie Shrek, it has layers. I tend to kind of, I'll have a seed idea, or I'll have, you know, some kind of, almost like a little, you know, the grain of sand that lands somewhere and slowly over time becomes a pearl. That's a very dramatic way of thinking of my own. Dramatic and perhaps vain way of thinking of my own writing. But it's very few ideas come to me completely formed or even close to it. And so it'll start as, you know, the real sort of catalyst for The Merciful Crow was an article I read on the lives of medieval executioners and their relationship with the communities that they served, because they were exiled from it. And they still had to serve them to kind of present this, you know, this manifestation of consequences. And that is a similar position to the role that crows serve, in that they, even though they are not responsible for the plague, they are so closely associated with it that they are a symbol of, you know, the consequences of being a bad person, hypothetically, according to the society's, you know, belief system. And yet, you know, they serve kind of as this reminder, but also that's just their lives and their job.
It's almost, I kind of got the impression that, like,
and so,
you know, they're so essential to, like, in our world, they would be essential workers to keep the world moving. But it's like, you know, they wouldn't.
Exactly.
It's almost like the other castes, like, they look down on them, but it's almost like they resent for having to need them. And it's like they're resentful for having to need them. And it's kind of like,
exactly,
you know, it's like you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't kind of thing. If you're if you're a crow, it's like, well, this is your responsibility. And if you don't answer the call, then everybody's going to hate you even more. It's like,
Right. Exactly. Even the little bit of power that they can exercise in not answering a plague beacon will, if not carefully managed, come back to bite them, because it antagonizes the communities that they depend on for payment. And there's a line in the first book that is pretty self-explanatory, where Hangdog, the kind of more short-sighted crow, is like, well, why don't we just, you know, leave them? Why don't we just ignore plague beacons? You know, why don't we just leave them alone and let them deal with their own problems? And Fi is like, and then the food that they give us in payment,
it's like we're still all, like, and it's all connected at one point, like, you know, somewhere down the food chain, somewhere down the chain of command, somewhere down the line. You know, it's like, well, we're going to get screwed either way if we don't take care of this. And it sucks, because it's like, this is the hand that they were dealt. And then it was like, you know, they struggle. And so that's, I think that's why it was so interesting and kind of like, you know, with the whole oath, it's basically like, and I did see like so many parallels mm-hmm. in the storyline and the, like the themes here mm-hmm. in your duology, like to our own world, where with the whole like Black mm-hmm. Lives Matter movement going on, and it was yes. like, it was just like, so mm-hmm. I just like, maybe just because this whole, we're just becoming so much more aware, of, you know, other how other people's mm-hmm. lives are, you know, they have to deal with the hand that they were dealt, unfortunately. But it's like, you know, the prince, yeah. in order to fulfill his oath, he has to like undo generations of like, you know, systemic like abuse and like prejudice and discrimination and all yes. that. And I was like, oh man, hold, like what, you know, how, what's with the timing here? You know,
it was how, like, how was that going to,
exactly, right. exactly.
What's the schedule for this?
That was really cool too, to just kind of notice how like, you know, it helped kind of relate to this different, because it's a very different world that you've kind of conjured up here, and but it's, you mm-hmm. know, there, you could still relate to Fi, people can still relate to Hangdog, who's like, you know, I don't know what the, like a little bit of a cynic, like, you know, and
just doesn't people, deal
it's like,
it.
You kind of yeah. see where he's coming from almost. And then mm-hmm. you can kind of, you know, relate also to like mm-hmm. Jasimir and Tavin. And, you know, I was really satisfied with the mm-hmm. character growth and development that Jasimir underwent. Yeah, no, that's my,
you.
you know, cause you can have the best storyline in the world. And I think if you can't really relate to characters, you just kind of make them one dimensional, or, you know, if they don't get anywhere based on like everything that they've been through, it's like, you know what,
right.
It kind of, you know, that has a, yeah, it's like, what are, you know, how, what are you using,
what are we
to
doing?
Grab,
right.
like what kind of story are you trying to tell if nobody's getting anywhere?
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. I love it. So
right, if nobody's growing.
Why did you decide? So this seems to very much be Fi's story. Why did you decide to write in third person mm-hmm. versus first person?
I actually almost always wrote in third person past. That was just a pretty much like a standard thing that I did. And I think it, like, the reason I chose to stick with it for The Merciful Crow, was that it felt like it gave a little bit more distance, and it was more, I'd say, I don't want to say indicative of Fi, but it was at times close, like pretty deeply buried in her POV. And there were times where it gave it a little bit of narrative distance when she herself would want to be able to control
right.
how close the narrative camera was, you know, in this story. And it allowed me to do things like, sort of contradict her in the moment, or be, you know, have there's a part where like there's a line in the book about her sitting on a rock and being like, I'm fine, it's
yeah.
great, and the next line is like, it was not fine, it really hurt to sit on this rock, but she's doing it anyway. And the story and the narration can kind of wink at the camera a little bit, but that becomes that's less self-aware than if Fi herself is saying,
right.
I'm just sitting on this to be an asshole, or I'm just doing this to be a jerk, because it allows me to sort of navigate and control the relationship.
Yeah, no, that's Fi really interesting, because authors who I've interviewed in the past have said, you know, when they write in third person, it makes them feel like a little more detached, like a little more like, oh, their characters are so far away. But then you're kind of mm-hmm. saying like, well, this, it seems like for you, it helps you give a little bit more control, or have a little bit more control, versus giving too much into the
yes.
character. Because yeah, no, it was mm-hmm. interesting. Cause like once you kind of get used to that narrative of like, yes, this is her story, you know, mm-hmm. what's being told in third person, but it's like, you could still see yourself as like, as her, and like reading it in as if it was your own inner thoughts, like,
right.
because you still, it can still come across that way. Yeah.
Yes. That was the idea. That, you know, one of the things that I remember, or I see every once in a while, someone saying, you know, how do you deal with a POV shift from first person to third? And honestly,
yeah.
unless there's a craft reason for it, my answer would just be switch the pronouns. Like, That's there's definitely a lot of processing that goes into it. But if you want a close third POV, in my opinion, there shouldn't be much of a difference between first person and third and the language that you use. It's, you know, it's just a matter of someone telling you someone else their story and telling you their story.
Because I've read both a lot of, you know, both third person and first person, and it's like usually if someone's writing third person, it's either because they're writing from different points of view back and forth, or you know, but I've also read books where it's multiple points of view that are still told in first person. So it's just interesting to get, you know, the reason behind some of those choices and seeing the differences and the kind of effects it has for, you know, for the story and for the reader too. I love the covers for both of these.
Me too.
You know, because I knew that you have I've looked at some of your artwork on your website. So how much of that came into play when you were, how much say did you have? Like, you know, what was the process like of coming up with some of the ideas? Were they, did they let you do your own thing, or were they like, well, no, this is what we're going to do? And you were like, no, like, like, did you have to fight for it, or were they kind of like relying on?
So
on
the good,
well?
it's Facebook complicated. Okay. the medium length answer is that my dad is actually a graphic designer. So there were some design principles I just kind of grew up with. And there were some that I picked up in like different classes in college. So there's certain things about composition and font choice that I just bring to the table going in and just being aware. Yeah. That said, the reality is that I also had to be realistic with myself that I love drawing. I love illustrating. I've done a couple sequential things. I've done, you know, some general portraits or, you know, and paintings and stuff, but I am not a cover artist, and there are things to consider like the market and other titles that are coming out when going into designing a cover. And so part of the struggle for me was telling myself I need to, or it wasn't much of a struggle, I just knew ahead of time that I needed to not get in the way. You know, I needed to not try to tell them how to do their job.
Right.
There's a very specific part of this book that I am being paid for. It is not the cover.
I was going to say, was that like really hard for you to do as like having a background in both like in print and graphic art, you know, like how hard was it for you to kind of step back and you know, let them.
I was prepared for it to be much harder than it was. And the nice thing, well, so the thing that I think a lot of folks don't actually know is that in your author contract, it will tell you exactly how much control you get over your cover. And for some folks, it's none. For some, it is consulting, which just means that they will show it to you and you can say, I don't like it. And they can say, too bad, Barnes & Noble does. And for some, it is actual like final approval where you, but that is very, very rare. And so mine was consulting, which was nice. And so if I had deeply hated the cover, then that would be a battle that I could pick to push for. However, I got real lucky in that in about October of 2018, I got the email with, here's the rough draft of the cover. What do you think? And I opened it and I was like, well, this is perfect. And done. And seen.
Right.
And there were a couple of things.
That was lucky like, for them too. Cause you know, who knows like how many people they work with. And it's like with authors who are, some of them work for years to tell a story. And if something's like comes out totally off, it could be difficult for
and
all parties.
I wanted to make sure that I wasn't trying to do something that was outside of my expertise. But also I was, you know, when I got the cover for Merciful Crow, I was just like, well, I have struck out. Like I've gotten very lucky because it was, it didn't look like anything else in the market at the time. And it still looked like it was, you know, on trend. And it's also captured exactly what I wanted the book to be. Or, you know, it conveyed exactly what I wanted it to convey, which is, this is about castles on fire.
Yeah, right. Right. No, exactly. And then you have
Fi just standing there just pure come at me,
right?
Bro.
And that's like, yeah, that really is her underlying attitude, where she kind of like she holds back because she's not in that place yet. She has to kind of stay in her lane. Mm-hmm. Because she's like mostly a chief in training, you know, for the most part, and mm-hmm. and she's not, you know, the head of command, not yet. And but right. then she, you know, you see her, and she has to like make really tough decisions. But at the end of the day, it comes down to looking out for her people, and it's like she has to make those decisions because this is what we do. Like at the end of the day, that we look out for our own, and it's like, you know, that's despite anything she. Those qualities that like takes to be a leader, like she gets to mm-hmm. exercise those. And, you know, cause I'm sure she's probably disagreed with Pa, her like mentor, father figure, you know, but she's just kind of like, well, it's his call kind of thing, or like, you know, and so that's right. at least that's what I got as the reader. And so like now, you know, and yeah, that cover like definitely symbolizes her like, okay, like she can breathe, like she doesn't have to ask permission because she's all that she has, and that it's up to her, like with all, you know, which is the right. circumstances, but she, you know, definitely getting caught up in some unexpected twists yeah. and turns, but, you know, mm-hmm. She handles it because right. she has no
and,
choice.
You know, that was kind of one of the parts of Pa and Faya's relationship that I enjoyed exploring in, I'd say, both books, was this idea that Pa is a little bit more of a diplomat. He's a little bit more, I wouldn't say reconciliatory. He is the kind of person who will make temporary sacrifices yeah. for the long-term good. And Fi understands that, you know, the sort of pragmatic argument, but she also is an opportunist in the best way, in that she's like, I'm not going to settle for just, you know, we're going to do enough to get by. I want our lives to be better.
Right. Yeah, no, and that's like another parallel that you kind of see today. It's like, you know, everybody's part of a system, and in this book, she's part of a system too, but she's like, you know, you have to maybe take the radical end of it to really get somewhere. And yeah. And so like, so did that, you know, your background and the, you know, when you tiptoed into, maybe you didn't tiptoe, cause you mm-hmm. sound like you were kind of immersed for a while in the political, world with the, you know, either campaign on the campaign trail mm-hmm. or working behind, you know, the scenes, you know, depending, you know, whatever was going on. Mm-hmm. So did that, those kind of things that you saw behind the scenes and like your work and those relationships and the networking that you had to do, or you saw other people had to do, you know, cause it is like, and there's politics everywhere. Mm-hmm. It's not just like, you know, we don't try to get political on the podcast, but like you see it, like even mm-hmm. the, you know, in the workplace, for example, you know, it's like more mm-hmm. likable people are likely to stand out more than the person who's working their butt off with, you know, with their head at their desk, you know, it's like, and right. so it's those kind of things where, you know, it comes down to, you know, maybe it is the loudest person in the room or the most charming person in the room. So like, were some of the things that you noticed in that, part of your, professional endeavors, so to speak, did that kind of like come to fruition or like give you ideas as to how to manage these, systems and relationships?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one of the things that I learned firsthand, cause I worked on a couple of different campaigns in Oregon and Washington, was that you can have people working for common goals for similar ends, and they may not get along at yeah. all. And that, you know, or, and even though we might, you know, people might be working for a common goal and say, you know, that goal could be, I believe in justice for everyone, but that person could still perpetuate, injustice within the office, that, you know, right, they could be right. making decisions that impact people in bad ways. And, you know, or that, you know, the other end of it is that you can see people who are, you know, they believe, they are maybe, you know, they don't, or maybe they believe in the cause, or, you know, they believe in the general goal, but when it comes to interrogating what that means for them and what that means from them, they kind of get tripped up a little bit. And it becomes a question of, well, what do we have to do? What do I have to give up to make this happen? And am I willing to do it?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's, you know, like I said, you'll find that, in so many, in so many environments. And it's, you know, it's especially like, you know, that brings me back to like what I was saying before in the book. It's like, you can see Vi, like, you know, she's like, how badly do I want this? Like, how badly do we need this? Like, how, you know, and it's and throughout the story, you see her constantly like battling, but then you also see her, it's almost like when she actually takes those actions, she acts as almost as if she never doubted herself in the first place, where she's just going, you know, just her personality. Right. She's just like, no, move out of my way. Like, you know, that kind of thing, and, which I loved, because it's easy to relate to that type of person too. It's like, we all, you know, there are people who seem so confident on the surface and seem to have it all figured out. But it's like, you know, no, like they're, it's like something, it's a lot of people, I think, just fake it till they make it, or they, you know, maybe the things that they seem most confident about are because they've weighed everything in their heads and they're like, well, no, this is how it has to happen. And, you know, there's like almost little to no wiggle room just because they've already weighed everything out. So what were, you know, trying to be spoiler free, but what were, you know, some of the most difficult, if not the most difficult scene for you to write?
Mechanics wise, I would say any of the chase scenes, any of the action sequences, those, sometimes when action sequences get very complicated, I actually have to storyboard them out and like just do thumbnails and be like, this is where everyone is in this room at this point in time. Emotionally, I would say, in the first book, there were, you know, a couple points where it was, you know, kind of emotionally tense a little bit. In the second book, without being too spoilery, there is a scene where Fi, you know, one of the well-documented tropes in YA is the girl who is different from everybody else, you know, the girl who's not like anybody else, everybody else. And I have always wanted to challenge that. And I don't set out to challenge it in every book I write, but I try to at least, you know, kind of challenge it at least a little. And there's a scene where Fi literally thinks, I wish I could be like every other girl. You know, I, you know, these are the kinds of lives that I know they're living because I've seen them in, you know, in the memories that I see, when I use my magic. And, for her to be sitting there thinking, I want to be a teen girl like everybody else gets to be a teen girl. That made me a little choked up. Also the, without spoiling much, the when they arrive at the Magnolia Groves, that scene was just like tears, because I was listening to the Moana soundtrack, and it's the scene where, or I was listening to specifically the part where she finds the boats, because it's supposed to have this kind of ancestral mystical feel, or ancestral mystical and almost holy feeling, and yet it's also kind of sad. Yeah. And for Fi, it's a very sad moment in the second book.
Yeah, no, I think going back to the point where you were saying where she kind of thinks like she longs for a normal, almost a normal life, or she longs for a life like other people her age. It was, I remember that because it was, you know, here we have this fierce female character who's, you know, she's like holding her own, she's making tough decisions, and, you know, maybe the reader's like, oh my God, like, you know, I wish I were more like her. But then later it's like, you know, she seems, you know, to deal with all these decisions and these circumstances that she's been thrown into. And then just to have her come around and be like, you know, I wish it wasn't like this for me. Like, I wish I was like that person. I wish I was like that person. And it's like, I, you know, if anybody ever on earth says they didn't you know, maybe look and see the grass was greener on the other side. If they say they've never had that thought, I would not believe them. I would say they're lying. Like, right. Of course, you know, especially in the days of social media, I'm like, nobody's posting about right. their bad moments. Like, nobody's, you right. know, and even in general, like, a lot of people are more likely to share, you know, the good things.
A very curated
yeah,
image.
Yeah. yeah. It's very, watered down, one-sided story that mm-hmm. we're all telling. And so, you know, for her to, you know, to have a character just straight up be like, you know, just be so honest about that and so vulnerable in mm-hmm. that moment, it was kind of an eye opener, like, you know, kind of going back to, you know, the people who just seem so confident. And it's like, you know, mm-hmm. they're not, I think there are very a small minority of people who, confident people who like, are naturally that way. I don't know. Or they've right. had, it's taken exactly. them a long time to reach that point. You know, mm-hmm. and so, yeah, no, I really appreciated that moment with Fi where she kind of like, you know, she opened up to the reader in that regard where, you mm-hmm. know, she knows that this is not, she's kind of sucking it up, but for a small moment, right. she's like, you know, like, I wish it wasn't like this for me. I wish I had, you know, somebody else's
right.
lifestyle or whatnot.
Exactly.
No, it was really powerful too. And especially since, you know, we follow this person and, you know, readers would fall in love with her. And then it's like, it just makes them fall in love with her more, I think. Just like, oh my God. Yeah. She's like, she's Aww. Not perfect. Like, she's not, you know, and
right.
She's not fierce. She's not a trailblazer. She is, but you know, she also, she's yeah. more than, she's
yeah,
more than that.
I think with female characters, some of the challenges that you want them, or we have we've tried to sort of embrace this idea of, you know, women can be strong, women can do anything. And at the same time, I think there's, when people don't stick the landing on it, it tends to be when it's like, well, this is what strength yeah. looks like. And it's this very kind of emotionless, consistently tough kind of, you know, very 90s comics version of right. strength, where it, you know, it comes it means being bulletproof
yeah.
and instead of being able to say that you were hurt. And to move on from
exactly.
that.
Exactly. And that's, you know, that's, I think that's also, you know, you can go on the other side with that, with male characters mm-hmm. is that, you know, the yes. strength is portrayed in a certain way.
Right.
You know, but I think, you know, it could definitely be a challenge to portray the strength and like, you know, say it's okay for men to be soft. It's okay for men mm-hmm. to have to make tough decisions in a human way and like to humanize
yes.
this, you know, it's, and I think that's what I appreciate a lot of, literature. They're kind of getting out there. They're getting, closer yes. to the multidimensional characters and they're exploring new ways to, create more relatable characters as well. And it's right. You know, mm-hmm. and also give people, insight as to like, you know, just more acceptance, which also I think is why, yeah. you know, I did appreciate that you, you know, you get extra points. I think I wrote that in my book review, is that you get extra, you get extra points for, representing the LGBTQ community.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Because I think that's really important too. Even if it's not like the main character, mm-hmm. just to have it, be present yeah. and then make sure, you know, just to make sure even that small little, a couple small, either side character or even like a secondary character, just mm-hmm. to kind of like throw that in there and as a part of who they are and what helps them grow too, even. And it's kind of, you know, it was interesting to that you made that it was the prince that, you know, was that way, because it was like, it has so many right. implications as well, even though it's like, mm-hmm. it's not, you know, it's just a part of who he is. It's his identity, but it's also mm-hmm. like, oh wait, but he's got, you know, he's the heir to the throne. Technically he's like, you know, mm-hmm. it's right. what, you know, how do we handle this? Where do we go from there? Kind of thing. So I think that mm-hmm. was a way that also, you know, you provided the representation, you provided a way to like, it's like, no, these people exist in real life and they can exist in fictional mm-hmm. worlds too. And,
exactly.
but it's like, oh, but wait, like that actually does have, you know, it might throw a wrench into things mm-hmm. if we're worried about of the line of succession. Mm-hmm. That's, you know,
right. We've got to think these things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, but I thought that was a nice, touch. I do want to be respectful of your time. And so I'll just, ask a couple last things. So are there any, projects that you're working on, or maybe you plan to start, like you've got in your head, or, any upcoming things that, you know, you're working on next to, you know, branch out into the world, right, and the literature.
It's funny. I think I mentioned earlier, that the book was acquired as a duology with the third book, as part of the contract. And I just turned in a revision of the third book, which we haven't announced the title yet. And I think I've talked a little bit more on Twitter just about what it's about and some fun stuff about the characters, including a list of names that the narrator calls her eventual love interest, which brings me a lot of joy. It's a completely different world, completely different setting, universe from The Merciful Crow, but it is, it's been a lot of fun to sort of break out and venture into a new world. This one is a retelling of The Goose Girl. I don't know if you're familiar with that fairy tale, because it's a lesser known one. It's a weird one. The Cliff Notes version is that a princess is engaged to the prince of another kingdom that's far away, and her mother sends her with a maid, to travel over there, to get married to him. And about midway through the journey, the princess is like, "Hey, go get me some water." And the maid's like, "Get it yourself." Oh. And right. And, the princess is like, okay. And, shenanigans ensue. And basically the maid steals her identity and is like, "I'm the princess now. You're going to have to work as a maid." And they reach the kingdom, that they were headed to, and the maid basically impersonates the princess while the real princess has to work as the king, in the castle as the goose girl. And, more fairy tale shenanigans ensue. And of course, you know, everybody's real identity gets revealed and restored, and everybody's happy, and the maid dies horribly. But I have written a retelling of that from the viewpoint of the maid.
Okay.
And I wanted to ask why, not just, you know, why would the maid want to steal this identity, and, you know, what is she trying to get, but also what is she running away from? And, I wanted to sort of engage in these ideas, because the first thing that you see in the first exchange you see in the fairy tale is the princess being like, "Hey, there's a river, go get me some water." And the maid being like, you can do that yourself, I assure you. it's treated as like, you know, this incredibly insulting exchange when it's just like, why does the princess need to be brought? Why can't she do it herself?
It's like, no, nobody's ever asked me that before.
Right, exactly. And so the premise is that it's about this girl who has been, she has been impersonating this princess who is betrothed to the ruler of this land. He has been absent for close to a year. And she, in the meantime, has used her access to these high society parties to basically case the joint and then steal a whole bunch of jewels. And the story opens right before she's about to pull off her 12th round of this. And she learns first that evening that a highly trained detective has been assigned to basically hunt her down. And then she finds later that she has in fact stolen from the wrong kind of people, because she winds up being cursed by a local god as a result. And she is going to turn slowly into jewels unless she finds a way to make up for everything that she has stolen. Wow.
Do you have a title for this?
I don't think we've announced it yet, so
okay.
I got to keep that
one under
wraps.
No, that's totally fine. But I was just curious, so I'm going to keep an eye out for it.
Hopefully, it should be out next year, because we are on track. Like, we should be on schedule.
Yeah, right.
Somehow, despite the Rona, I mean, what else are you going to do?
Like, you know.
Right?
Yeah. So just one last thing before we let you go here. Mm-hmm. Do you have any book recommendations for me?
It depends on what you are looking for in the moment.
Well, I don't know. Just give me whatever comes to mind, because I, you know, who knows, if I'm not into it right now, I might be into it, you know, 5 months from now.
I always go with L.L. McKinney's A Blade So Black. That is a pretty surefire home run.
Okay. Was that a recent release?
The first one came out in 2018. What? It's a trilogy, and the second one just came out last year. The third one will be out in, I think, I almost said smart. I think either spring of next year or like early next year. So it will be out in the first half of next year. I'm just not sure when.
Okay, well, perfect. Because then if I get started, if I don't get started until March, then at least I won't have to wait long for the completion.
Yeah, it's a loose retelling of Alice in Wonderland, but the basic pitch is, what if Buffy fell down the rabbit hole instead of Alice?
Oh, okay.
And it is fantastic.
Oh, though, that's really interesting. Because people are getting just like, they have to be creative these days, you know, to come up with mm-hmm. new stories, but still, wouldn't think of that at all.
Right?
Yeah. But okay. Thank you so much, Margaret, once again, for taking the time. And, I know that maybe you don't have a whole lot on your plate right now, but we appreciate you taking the time to speak with us, and so that our readers and listeners can get to know more about you and Fi and her clan, and her story, and what we have to look forward from your brain within the next with your next installment, with your next release.
Of course. So, thank you for having me. This has been absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you.
And thank you very much for listening to this interview with Margaret Owen. You can find links to all of her social media pages and links to purchase the books over at thenerdcantina.com/show96. Again, the second book in this duology here releases on August 18th, and you can pick it up at your favorite bookstore or from her website or online at many other retailers. As always, we want to thank you for listening. We hope you enjoy these in-depth, long discussions with these authors, and we hope that you are visiting the website every once in a while to check out the in-depth reviews that give more of Megan's personal opinion on these authors' work. As always, we'll ask you to leave us a rating review on your podcast player, or at least hit that subscribe button and maybe that auto-download button, as all of those numbers help us to gain some traction and get out in front of more people and hopefully have more people benefit from these great interviews with authors, as well as our weekly news wrap-ups that we provide every Wednesday. So thanks again. We'll talk to you next week, nerds.